A friend of mine, who is also a colleague, posted a picture of her living room the other day on Facebook. Real life, she said. And there it was, in all of its glory. Toys strewn about, the fireplace I had envied, boarded up with a toy barn. Layers of clothes like people passed out on couches. Last night's wine glass, I saw it, and this morning's breakfast. May you find peace in your day today, she wrote. Even if there are piles of laundry and chaotic heaps of toys in every corner. You can tell, I'm guessing, from my tone of voice, from my enthusiasm at describing this picture, that I studied every detail that was offered in that snapshot. Yes, there was the teether for the baby that the dog was sniffing. Yes, I think those clothes are dirty. They didn't make it to the laundry, but she was so close. Part of me was rooting her on, another part embarrassed by my glee in discovering my dear friend's imperfections, all for the sake of humanizing myself. I'm not proud to stand here before you with such an admission, but the truth is, every day it gets a little harder to look around my home and see any semblance of a balanced life. There are traces of creatures who live there, people I once knew but now are just tired and confused bodies who wake at 4 a.m. and are learning the relationship between coffee pots and potty seats, bribery and judgment by people in the grocery store who are clever enough not to wear clothes in public with spit up adorning their shoulders. The creatures move quickly and without much thought. Their food is almost always frozen before it is cooked, and their keys are always lost. On good days, I can laugh at it all, marvel at it even, at the chaos, at the speed of life. But on some days, it takes every morsel of my energy, a heavy lift of the heart, to decide to see beauty in what otherwise feels like a breakdown. And so it is with many places in our lives these days. Disarray not only in our living rooms, but in the public debate of who will be seated in our courtrooms, and therefore in the hidden rooms of our hearts, the hidden rooms of our bodies, the places we've hid. Which leads to a flooding of grief, trauma re-traumatized like a wave over our heads, mouths wide open. Except there are waves too, floods and fires, water we can't bless or use as a blessing. On some days, I marvel at it, the chaos, and think, as if a reminder to myself, this is life. This is the life I love. This is the life I want every person to love so that the chaos quiets. On some days, I marvel. But other days, it is a heavy lift to make my eyes, my heart, my spirit see and name the beauty. Life is short. Though I keep this from my children, begins Maggie Smith's poem, Good Bones. Life is short, and I've shortened mine in 1,000 delicious, ill-advised ways. 1,000 deliciously ill-advised ways I will keep from my children. The world is at least 50% terrible, and that's a conservative estimate, though I keep this from my children. For every bird, there is a stone thrown at a bird. For every loved child, a child broken, bagged, sunk in a lake. Life is short, and the world is at least half terrible, and for every kind stranger, there is one who would break you, though I keep this from my children. I am trying to sell them the world. Any decent realtor walking you through a real dump chirps on about good bones. This place could be beautiful, right? you could make this place beautiful. We often emphasize both the Judeo and the Christian origins of Unitarian Universalism, but in truth, we are a product of American Protestantism and in many ways still fall securely within this category of religion today. There are basically four distinct theological generations in America starting in the late 1800s, and my guess is they will sound familiar, even if you don't know to put them on some historical timeline. From about 1880 to the early 1900s, America is in this period of missionary enthusiasm. The goal for Christians of the time is to evangelize the world during that modern generation. Then from about 1905 through 1930, we move into what's known as the social gospel movement. Here is when we meet the historical Jesus and begin to understand and emphasize the politics and ethics of his life. Christianity becomes contextual to centuries before, but what we see is a world that looks too similar today, and so Protestantism becomes a social justice movement as much as a place of spiritual depth. From about 1930 to 1955, players like Reinhold Niebuhr and Paul Tillich change the landscape again from an idealism that is entrenched in the progressive theological perspective of the time. They are met with the despair and ugliness of the Great Depression and World War II. And from them, we see a reassessment and a reclaiming of words like sin and a theology of the fallen state of human nature, all while holding on to this charge of social justice as a religious act and the only saving grace. I imagine some of this feels familiar, sounds familiar, head nods. You can say no, too. Then I know what I need to preach about in the times to come. And maybe you didn't know the titles of each of these periods, but I'm guessing you can feel their influences in American religion still today, in American landscape, regardless of denomination or entrenched secularism in life today. Those were three of those generations. Does anyone know what the title of the next is, the one that secures Unitarian Universalism? It's the one, in fact, in which the Unitarians and the Universalists merge to become one religion. Against my better judgment, we call it the Death of God movement. And it is entirely born out of a reaction to the world in despair. World War II ends. The Cold War is brewing, Vietnam, civil rights, Kennedy and King are assassinated, Stonewall, and many of you in the room can recall yourselves. And it's not just tragedy, but it is counterculture. The Beatles and Woodstock, a human walks on the moon. You could name again King and Kennedy. Things are changing. And where there are joys, we can point to a human or a community of people who made it so. And where there is grotesque despair, we can again point to the human capacity to cause such pain. Clergy and lay people alike, secular and religious, begin to speak and sing the antsiness of Sunday morning messages. Why do we keep calling out to a God to save us when we are the ones who have caused this mess to begin with? What's interesting is that what comes next is not a story of only negation or mockery of those who claim a traditional faith, hardly. But instead, where I find my joy in this time period entrenched in the word death is how stories of beauty and power that don't just allow but charge us humans with a new sense of how the holy is at play in the world, within each and all, among and in the intimate, like a starless night, dark, our eyes were adjusting. We could begin to see the flame that made our own lives the co-creators of the world, a heaven readied if only we made it so. I grieve for this time, for this generation, though it was never my own. Though I suppose in being given this faith as a child, it became mine. That period in which it was chosen to see the holy among us out of the despair has shaped every thought and action and belief that makes up me. Because I was given this tradition born out of that time. And so I grieve for it now while navigating a world that seems to want to replicate the ugliness of 50 years before, but in our depletion, our exhaustion doesn't seem as ready, as wanting, as inspired on our bad days to also replicate a beautiful empowerment, a new language of divinity, a recognition as if for the first time of the sacredness of which we are a part. What happens to us if we stop believing, stop having faith in the saving power of humans? What happens to the world, big and small, our planet, the spirit of you and me? What happens if we stop at the world is at least half terrible? Parker Palmer and peers in his work like Richard Rohr and others, they speak of something called creative tension, or I prefer his tragic gap. He basically offers that there are two ways we are taught to live in the world. One is cynicism, a place of suspicion and scarcity, a despair that draws the covers over our eyes or teaches our tongues to spit meanness as if a message of surrender to the way it is. Cynicism, as you know, hardens the world and adds to the harshness. And then the other is idealism, a naivety that can make us irrelevant in how we seem to ignore the world's realities, butterflies and rainbows, privilege dismissed as hard work or good luck, targets on every corner, and little boxes made of ticky-tacky. But there is a third way, he argues. A third way that rests and resists and requires grit and want, but is also dreamlike and motivating, nourishing and salvific, which is to live sturdily in that tragic gap that is made of the space between cynicism and idealism, the space that will never be filled, Parker reminds us, but in which we can move forward and perhaps lessen that cavern that divides. A third way between what is and what could be. I'm sure there is some name for whatever theological generation we are in right now, something we can blame on the millennials and the nuns, the spiritual but not religious. My hope, though, is that we are moving into a third way in which we are of the world but not broken by it. In which we can feel the way our bodies and souls spring to life when we receive the gifts of the world, when we co-create them, but we do not hide away in our pleasures, addicted to the comfort nor fed by the fear. We began this morning by reminding one another that we are covenantal, that we make promises only as good as our willingness to apologize and our want to begin again. We often talk about the covenants between one another, but not often enough about the covenants we have with the larger world. If we are to be a people who can see peace in the chaos, who can find laughter in the exhaustion, who can make something beautiful of the good bones that have been stripped and worn over time, a people neither cynical nor naive, we must remember our sacred promise to imagine something other than what we know. Our evolution from a fallen humanity, our vision given flesh, promising, beginning again and promising again to lessen the divide between what is and what can be. Some days it will be a matter of attention and choosing what we see. Toys strewn about just might mean that we've lost all control, but also that our children have found joy in their homes. Some days it will require a sturdy, surgical hand that removes depleting narratives from our hearts. Debates in the public square may not awaken hurt and wounds for no purpose but entertainment, and instead afford us a people with whom we can name our truths and feel the holding of those who will not look away. Some days, we will need to be lifted from our floors, covers pulled back, and drenched in the sounds of those who love us, calling us to our feet. Humans who aren't perfect or without the ability to harm, but who are likely our best bet in cultivating, as my colleague Victoria Safford says, not sunshiny optimism, but a gritty, serviceable hope. This life has good bones. I believe we can make it beautiful. I believe we have. I believe we must. May it be so, and may we make it so. Amen.